open the House Committee on Redistricting.
Do we have that link?
Good morning. I'm opening the Senate Committee on Redistricting for today, Friday, February 25th, 2011.
I forgot to mention the date, but it's still the same date for the House. Good morning. We're here today to talk mostly about communities of interest. We have a guest joining us, Professor Levitt, again, who we heard from a couple weeks ago. Our first order of business is a work session to adopt an appendix of guidelines for accessing and using committee services, redistricting, technical support, equipment, and guidelines. So, Mr. Co-Chair, would you please make a motion?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move to adopt Appendix A, Guidelines for Access and Usage of Committee Services Redistricting Technical Support, Equipment, and Amendments as an appendix to the House Redistricting Committee Rules.
Chair Lindsay moves to adopt Appendix A, Guidelines for Access and Usage of Committee Services Redistricting Technical Support, Equipment, and Amendments as an appendix to the House Redistricting Committee Rules. Is there any discussion? Colleagues, you've been provided hard copies of this. If you have any questions about the details, I would suggest they be referred to Aaron Seiler, who can answer those questions. But this basically regulates how staff will be made available to other members. We have special guidelines given the nature of the work we're undertaking here. These are similar to what was done 10 years ago. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Great. Motion passes, and the appendix of the rules is adopted.
And the Senate committee will be waiting because we don't have enough members here to adopt our appendix, so we will wait until we get another member here, and if we don't, we'll adopt them next week.
All right. Thank you. So we'll close the work session and now open an informational meeting on communities of interest. We're going to start with an overview of the law. We have two presenters. Gina Zedlick from Legislative Council will be addressing us. But first we have Professor Justin Levitt from the Brennan Center for Justice at Loyola University. Welcome back, Professor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
And we'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. I once again greatly appreciate the invitation to speak to you today. I hope to be as informative as I was last time, or if you thought the presentation was not up to par last time, then twice as informative. I had prepared about 10 minutes of an overview of how communities of interest are treated in Oregon and how that corresponds to the law nationwide, and then wanted after that short presentation to leave the session open to you and your questions to the extent you wanted to ask me further questions. The basic status of the law gives you a tremendous amount of discretion, and so most of what I'm going to lay out for you is a description of that discretion rather than describing constraints on what you can do or must do. There are two essentially ways in which communities of interest are treated under the law. The first, very briefly, is in how race or ethnicity may be considered. The Supreme Court has said that beyond the Voting Rights Act, race or ethnicity may be considered in the drawing of district lines only to the extent that it does not predominate. It is not first among all the considerations that you or your colleagues take into account. What that means is that if you wish to consider the race or ethnicity of your constituents or voters in an area in order to draw districts, it has to be done, it can be done, but it has to be done in the context of considering many other traditional districting criteria, what the court has labeled traditional districting criteria. Consideration of political boundaries, of drawing districts that are relatively compact, or drawing districts that put together communities of common interest. Put differently, if you draw districts that aim to keep communities with common interests together, that gives you more latitude under the court's rules to also consider race or ethnicity in the mix. It is one of the factors the court points to that are permissible to take into account when you are also taking into account race or ethnicity. So that's a a way in which considering communities gives you extra latitude under the federal laws governing redistricting. The other way in which communities of interest can and or should be considered has to do with an affirmative mandate to attempt to draw districts that keep communities together. The Supreme Court has been very clear. There's no federal constitutional requirement to keep communities of interest together. That's not an independent mandate in constitutional law. States, however, have the latitude to take communities of interest into account when they wish. And like Oregon, 23 other states have done so with respect to their state legislative districts, and at least 13 other states have done so with respect to their congressional districts. Oregon has also chosen to do so. It's not in the Oregon Constitution, but it is represented as one of several factors in Oregon statutory law in section 188.010 that your predecessors in the legislature have declared the legislature will and should consider withdrawing districts, and that the Secretary of State will and should consider withdrawing districts if she's called upon to draw districts if the legislature cannot come to an agreement on the statute. One very quick note on that mandate or that discretion is that, as I just mentioned, this requirement in Oregon law was set in statute. And what that means is that you may have the latitude to change that requirement by a subsequent statute. It's only as binding as any other statute and subject to amendment or repeal or withdrawal or change like any other statute. In other states, most notably Michigan, that have set criteria like communities of interest by statute. In Michigan, in the last cycle, the legislature, in fact, passed a redistricting bill that was enacted into law that did not wholly abide by the more general principles that were also enacted by statute earlier. And the courts in Michigan, at least, said, that's fine. The more general principles embodied in statute were effectively overridden by the more narrow, distinct drawing of district lines by a subsequent statute. So that latitude that you have is something that you may or may not wish to keep in mind. That said, I think that both you and the citizens of Oregon are very well served in representing communities of interest in the districts that you draw. And so I'm encouraged by the fact that you've laid it out as a principle that you wish to abide by in your statutes as currently presented and in the rules that the Secretary of State has promulgated. It is, communities of common interest are a legalistic phrase, but they actually refer to something very basic to representation. They are communities of individuals that have similar interests and that allow you to better represent them because they allow you to know what it is that your constituents hold dear, what they have in common, that you're better able to represent by knowing that they have interests in common. What can those common interests be? It's not specified in the Oregon statute. The statute says only that it directs you to take into account communities of common interest, but doesn't further delineate what those may be. The Secretary of State's rules clarify ever so slightly, but also give a tremendous degree of latitude. The Secretary of State has said what this means to him when they were promulgated now to Secretary Brown. Where urban neighborhoods, rural communities, or other communities can be identified, an attempt will be made to retain that community within a single district. And also states that consideration will be given to market areas covered by local media. That essentially just says, if there are communities, we're going to try to keep them together, but doesn't tell you much more about what those communities may be. Other states had considered many, many, many factors. They considered social interests, they had considered cultural interests, race or ethnicity, economic or trade interests, urban interests, rural interests, geographic interests, historical interests, communication and transportation networks, occupations and lifestyles, living standards, transportation facilities themselves, and, as the Secretary of State's rules indicate, media markets. Many of these things can contribute to what a group of citizens may have in common that would be best served by a particular coherent representation. And in the last cycle, in Oregon, the Secretary of State's report indicated that many of that long list of interests that I just communicated were in fact used, some in different places in the state, in order to draw districts. What all of this means is that you all have quite broad discretion under the law in deciding whether any particular constellation of individuals in an area has a common interest and what that common interest may be. I'll close my presentation with three thoughts that I offer in an attempt to help guide your discretion, but you are free to take them as you wish or describe them as you wish. First, just as you're doing in testimony today, and I know that you have quite a bit more testimony to follow my presentation, I would urge you to continue listening to your constituents around the state. The people who live in a particular area have some rather definite, some somewhat hazier ideas about what they and their neighbors have in common and what is most salient to them. And so the more that you hear from your own constituents, from the voters of Oregon, about what they care about most in a particular area, the more your deliberations about communities of interest will be informed by what the people actually believe. So I encourage you to continue, just as you're doing today, to continue taking testimony and hearing from the people of Oregon about what communities they feel matter most. Second, I would urge you to understand that the definition of a valid community of interest may change in different areas of the state, and that they should change in different areas of the state. That is, different interests will be salient to different degrees, depending on the local population, and that's fine. In one particular area, a community of interest may be best defined by something they have culturally in common. In another area of the state, the most salient community of interest may be defined on economic grounds or on occupational grounds or on grounds of particular trade. And that's fine. There's no overriding rule to have the same criterion govern what is considered the most salient community of interest in uniform fashion across the state. In fact, if you're trying to keep the most important communities of interest together in districts in different parts of the state, you may need a different guideline as to what the important community of interest is in a particular area. Finally, while hard numerical data, real numbers from the census or elsewhere, may contribute to your understanding of what constitutes the most important community of interest, I would also encourage you not to be bound unduly by things that are most easily quantified. There may well be a particular cultural community of interest in an area that is quite salient to the voters, but somewhat harder to put a strict numerical finger on. That doesn't mean that it's any less legitimate. It just means that it's more difficult to quantify in the measures that we have today. But I would urge you not to be distracted if there is a particularly strongly felt community that doesn't happen to map well onto particular quantitative data that you have in front of you. I would say similar things go for consideration of communities of interest as regards to political boundaries, whether they fit neatly within political boundaries or whether they happen to spill over. In some parts of the state, you may well find that communities fit very nicely and neatly within, and maybe are even defined by, city lines, county lines, or other political boundaries. And in other parts of the state, you may well find that a community of interest is very strong and overlaps or spills beyond particular city or county lines. And I would urge you not to give undue weight to that particular political boundary if it in fact cuts off a community. Your own statutes and the Secretary of State's guidelines give equal weight to political boundaries and communities of interest, and they give different. They make them distinct. And I would urge you to not add priorities where you have not already chosen to do so in an abstract fashion, but to be guided by whatever may be most salient locally. And that's really the presentation that I have. As you've seen, what it essentially involves is a lot of discretion for you in hearing from voters around the state to decide what may be the most important community of interest in a particular place. The courts have made very clear that as long as there is some basis for your decision, they're not particularly interested in reviewing that decision to see if you were correct or whether there's a better alternative. And so this really is in your hands, and if for some reason the process breaks down, in the hands of the Secretary of State.
All right, thank you very much. We also have Gina Zedlick from Legislative Council. If you want to come up and offer your thoughts, maybe we can take questions then at the end for both. Can you stay on for a couple more minutes, Professor Levitt?
Absolutely, I'd be delighted.
Okay, thank you. Gina.
Hi, my name is Gina Zedlick from the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I'll just try and go through with a little bit more specificity the history of the statute and the requirement for considering communities of interest in Oregon. The legislature adopted ORS 188.010 in 1979, so that would be right before the 1980 census. And in 1981, challenges were brought based on the statute, and the Supreme Court, the Oregon Supreme Court, said that they could not consider the statute. They couldn't consider the criteria of the statute because in the their constitutional mandate, it very specifically said, the court shall review, is vested with original jurisdiction to review plans based on Article 4, Section 6, Sub 1. It was very specific. So the court in McCall decided it couldn't address that. So in 1986, at a general election, the voters approved an amendment to the Constitution, specifically to Article 4, Section 6, that in addition to doing other things, expanded the scope of review that the court could consider when faced with a challenge to a redistricting plan. So now, and it's currently in our law, that the court will review a plan based on compliance with constitutional requirements, but also all law applicable thereto. So in 1991, in Otter v. Kiesling, it was the first time since that constitutional amendment had been adopted that the court was faced with a challenge to a redistricting plan. And so in 1991, the court acknowledged that the Constitution had changed and that its scope of review had expanded. And now, in addition to evaluating whether the legislature or Secretary of State has complied with the Constitution, the court also reviews based on this statute. And as Professor Levitt said, that, of course, is a statute. It is subject to change with subsequent law. However, right now it stands as a requirement that constrains the legislature or the Secretary of State in drawing lines this time around. So based on Otter v. Kiesling in 1991, we learned from the court that, you know, the requirements of 188.010 do matter. The question is how do they matter, and, you know, with what specificity is the court going to look into the decisions made by the legislature or Secretary of State? And the court's approach, as Professor Levitt said, has been fairly hands-off in terms of looking at evaluating the facts. The court has said that its task is not to substitute its judgment for the wisdom of the plan. And it basically has acknowledged the broad discretion that it does give to the Legislative Assembly or Secretary of State, as long as that plan is consistent with the fundamental requirements of the Constitution and the statute. And to illustrate this, in 1991, immediately, you know, after the court, after the constitutional amendment and ORS 188.010 was kind of in effect, people did begin bringing challenges based on division of communities of interest, in addition to other things. But since that's what we're here talking about today, there was a specific claim in that case that a certain neighborhood was divided, that 10 people should go over here because that's where the rest of their neighborhood went. And underlying their challenge was actually, I think it was the first time that the Secretary of State adopted a very specific deviation plan. They didn't want to deviate based on the set, you know, they didn't want to deviate more than plus or minus 1%. And so they had kind of formally adopted that. And so part of the challenge was saying, well, we think that the petitioners thought that maybe that strict of a population deviation would derogate the other factors that you're required to consider. So, and the court, in looking at that, said, basically kind of established their approach as the hands-off. They said, as long as that the body, the Secretary of State or the Legislative Assembly, has considered the criteria in a lawful way, in accordance with you know, the Constitution, that it's not going to second guess the judgment of the drawer of the plan, and so the court will look at whether the criteria has been considered. So that's communities of interest, you know, the transportation links, all those things that are listed in 188, but only to the extent that they're considered. It's if there's more than one reasonable way to judge that, the court will go with based on the public record of the Legislative Assembly or Secretary of State or whoever drew that plan. So I think in going forward, and as you hear testimony today, you know, and as Professor Levitt has already described, that they're fluid, and but what is important is establishing a record of that's based in fact and is defensible. That's all I have.
All right, thank you. Do we have questions for either Senator Brzezinski?
Gina, could you give us the statute or statutes that you're referencing? I didn't get them when you were saying at the beginning.
Yeah, the statute is ORS 188.010.
Thank you.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a question for Professor Levitt. You mentioned something about a Michigan case, and I just wondered, because it's my understanding you said that they considered the requirements in statute but then did not apply them, but it was still upheld. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Sure. Please. Thank you, Senator. What I was referring to is, in this notion, and Gina just mentioned it a moment ago, that the requirements that you have, like the requirements that Michigan had, are statutory. And at least in Michigan, the court viewed those statutory requirements as able to be amended or overridden by any subsequent statute. And at least in Michigan, whether the legislature formally declared a repeal or modification or not. So in Michigan, the statute suggested that the legislature would take into account 4 or 5 factors in drawing district lines. When the legislature actually passed a redistricting bill, the bill formally drawing the districts for the state after the census, we considered or followed 2 or 3 of those statutory criteria, but not others. And the Michigan Supreme Court said, what we've got here is a war of two statutes. The first statute set up general criteria. The second statute followed some criteria and not others. And the Michigan Supreme Court said, at least in Michigan, that's fine. The second statute must have impliedly repealed those portions of the first statute that were in conflict. And the legislature, because it can change statutes at will, has that right. Exactly as Gina's mentioned, the Oregon Supreme Court seems to have taken a different approach so far, although this wasn't strictly at issue in any of the cases over the last few decades yet. That is, the legislature set up statutory rules, 188.010, and then seemed to at least consider, if not follow, or at least the record reflected a basis for believing that the legislature followed, that the Secretary of State followed those statutory rules throughout. The Oregon Supreme Court was never called on to decide whether a new redistricting statute impliedly repealed part of 188.010 or not. And so today, you have a binding requirement in statute to abide by the criteria set out in 188.010, unless or until you decide to modify them by statute. And no legislature in Oregon has yet taken steps that make it obvious that a redistricting statute passed as part of the normal procedure deviates from 188.010. And so that issue as to what the impact of such a thing would be hasn't come before the courts yet.
Thank you. Fascinating.
I don't know whether that clarifies or confuses.
No, it does. It's just an interesting issue. Thank you.
Chair Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually a question for both of you. You've explained that we have broad discretion. I'm wondering if either of you know of any explicit direction saying thou shalt not consider this a community of interest.
At least for my part, Mr. Chair, the only thou shalt not that exists in the current statutes would be a community of interest defined specifically around a particular political party or incumbent or other individual. And that's only because there is you've already heard about a complementary portion of the statute that specifically directs districts not to be drawn for the purpose of favoring a political party, incumbent, or other person. So I would think that if you have a community and you define that community of interest as a community of Democrats or a community of Republicans or a community of people who very much liked X or Y legislator, I could anticipate a court deciding that that wasn't a proper definition of community. Beyond that, I think you're free to determine that common interest that best suits the voters in a particular area.
Co-Chair Lindsay, I think actually Professor Levitt made this point earlier, but also the way that race plays out, I think he explained it better than I could, but he, as he said, it's basically, it's only a prohibited criteria depending on how you consider it. So in addition to considering all these other criteria, a community of interest based on race, that's legal if it's the only thing that you're considering in your drawing lines to dilute their voting strength or to do, you know, to it's depending on how you use that information, it could be a prohibited category.
General Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this too may be a question for both of you. I don't know for sure, but in Professor, you made some reference to when we use a community of interest to make a decision on where to draw the line, that we needed to have some basis for making that decision. And I was curious about the extent of the documentation that would be required for recognizing that as your basis. Could it be on the back of a napkin, or, you know, just what are your thoughts on that?
I think it probably could be on the back of a napkin, though I don't know that that's what I'd recommend. Exactly as Dean has indicated, the courts have thus far shown deference to legislative determinations or to the determinations of the Secretary of State about what it is that provides reason to believe that the legislature considered communities of interest and acted on them. And that deference essentially maps onto the court's traditional rational basis test, in which, as long as it looks exactly as Gina said, like the procedures set out by law were properly followed, they're not going to second guess whether some particular quantum of documentation was enough or insufficient. So as long as there is some reason to believe that you're defending a particular district based on your decision to consider a community of interest, as long as there's some reason to believe that that community exists, I don't know that the courts have gotten into the business of saying a certain level of documentation is sufficient but not others.
Representative Pulvey, members of the committee, I think I would also add that in the Oregon cases that have been considered since the adoption of the statute, the Secretary of State has been the one to enact the plan. And along with the plans, I don't know if you've seen it, but there would be the plan, and then there's also for each district, each House district, each Senate district, probably a few sentence blurb saying here's why these lines are drawn this way. And that's something that the court accepted as part of the record and relied on. And that obviously wouldn't be a part of the legislature's bill exactly the same way, but having a record like that, I think, is part of what allowed the court to defer, to allow the deference that it did, to say here are the reasons that the Secretary of State has, you know, said that they've drawn these lines, and so it gave them something very tangible to look at.
Senator,
thank you. And this is a question, I guess, to both. If I remember correctly, when we had some of our first briefings, the state legislature does have flexibility when we're setting the legislative districts. If I remember correctly, we have up to 10% deviation that we can meet to actually come up with a district. I'm assuming that will allow us, when we go out and, as we hear today, the community of interest, we can go in and some of the areas in my current district, I questioned why they were split. It seemed like there were lines drawn in the middle of a community of interest, and we've actually had constituents question that. So is it safe to say that once we go through this process, we could, quote-unquote, reconnect areas that we find now 10 years later to be more of a community of interest? So long as we stay within that 10% deviation, the court should be willing to accept it if we have actually demonstrated and have made a record that this is why these communities have been, let's say, reconnected, as compared to, of course, the federal congressional districts are much more strict as to the deviation of population.
Senator Prusansky, members of the committee, maybe Professor Levitt can add to this, but I would caution you as using that as a guaranteed okay. Basically, what the 10% is that. You know, a court has upheld that. That's kind of the outer limits of what has been upheld as a deviation that's been allowed, given the importance of other factors. It's not always safe, and courts have invalidated much less, much smaller population deviations. You could have a very small population deviation in a district, and other things might invalidate it if it's been drawn obviously to favor a political party, for example. I mean, some of those things are going to be on their face suspicious. I don't think we have a very, a perfect population deviation doesn't guarantee a lawful plan. I think it really is, I mean, as the court, the Oregon Supreme Court here has said, it really looks at consideration of all those criteria. And then in your judgment, the legislature's or the Secretary of State's judgment, whether the balance of those, if it's more important to, in one area honor a community of interest, that makes for a greater population deviation. Professor, do you have anything to add?
Well, I'm going to largely agree. Senator and members of the committee, Gina, said it exactly right. There is no guarantee. What the courts have been focused on is there is latitude to the legislature for drawing state legislative lines for a good reason. And precisely as Gina indicated, there's no ironclad definition of what those good reasons are. you're pointing out as bad reasons, that is, pure partisan political gain or individual incumbent gain, have been by some courts declared to be bad reasons that don't justify a deviation. And there are signs that indicate that a reason will be upheld as good, but no ironclad guarantee. The more consistent you are across the state in the way you go about establishing a basis for deviations, the more likely it is that a court's going to say that the population deviations you've got are for a good reason. And so to the extent that if you have a particular community that you wish to keep intact, that would require some population deviation well within the 10% threshold, the more that you can be consistent about documenting that community and explaining the reasons for keeping that community intact, the more likely it is that a court's going to say this deviation is an acceptable one.
Thank you.
All right, any further questions? Looks like not. Thank you both very much. Professor Levitt, thank you again very much for joining us. It's been very helpful.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the chance to be before you today.
Thank you.
We're going to take just a break from the public hearing. I'm going to open up the work session and ask for a motion on the adoption of the Appendix A.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt Appendix A, Guidelines for Access and Usage of Committee Services Redistricting Technical Support Equipment and Amendments as an appendix to the Senate Redistricting Committee Rules.
Vice Chair Telfer moves to adopt Appendix A, Guidelines for Access and Usage of Committee Services Redistricting Technical Support Equipment and Amendments as an appendix to the Senate Redistricting Committee Rules. Is there any discussion?
Easy for y'all to say.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, Appendix A is adopted. The motion is passed, and I'll close the work session. We need to reopen it.
Do I have to reopen the hearing?
Do we have to reopen a hearing? I think you do.
Still open. Still open.
I'll reopen it.
Okay, we will resume our invited testimony on communities of interest. Also, just so everyone is aware, it's the intention of the chairs next week to convene again in a joint hearing to have a presentation on the new census data, which was just received. We don't expect that will take the full 2 hours, so I think what we're going to do is use the remainder of that time to continue the hearing on communities of interest. So if there's anybody else who feels that they would like to be considered for inclusion in that, feel free to contact us or the committee staff. We expect to maybe have another hour or so of testimony on that next week. So we will proceed with citizen associations and communities of interest. We'll start with Cappy Eaton and Francisco Lopez, please.
Members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cappy Eaton, the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I think most of you know about the league, so I'm not going to give you the boilerplate about who we are. But we're particularly concerned that equity and representation of citizens in Oregon legislative districts, the realignment of those districts is important and of interest to all of us. And a side comment, I believe that Oregon has done very well in the way in which it has the consistency that the professor was talking about. We have usually had considerably less than 10% deviation across the state, and that has been taken into consideration by the Supreme Court when it looked at the plan. The Oregon Law 188010 sets forth the criteria to be used in the redistricting process. And although population is considered the primary element, communities of interest have become one of the top considerations. Generally speaking, communities of interest are defined as areas shared by socioeconomic, ethnic, graphic, economic, or other interests. The definition should not include any relationship between a community and a political party, incumbent, or candidate. Basing districts on communities with shared interest allows the public, the elected public official, to better represent those constituents. However, though it may produce the representation of diverse views in the legislature, it also may make compromise more difficult when you're discussing issues in the legislature. Existing boundaries may not always correspond to particular interests, where the divisions could be as mundane as a road. The U.S. Supreme Court has accepted varying definitions of communities of interest, but state legislatures have seldom defined it. For example, the redistricting process should include multiple across-the-state meetings to help avoid diluting the voting rights of underrepresented communities. There is, however, the risk that communities of interest could be used as a pretext to justify district boundaries that do not further legitimate objectives. Too much weight should not be given to existing communities of interest or existing political boundaries or geographic barriers, because that can reduce competitiveness. We ask league members around the state to provide examples of communities of interest in their specific areas, and here are some of their responses. I'm going to read them as they came to me in email, so I'll go from one to the next. It may be helpful, said one, to look at metropolitan planning organizations, area communities of transportation, and jurisdictions that could have done regional economic planning. Another, particularly at the city level, consideration to be given to highways, rivers, and railroad tracks as neighborhood boundaries. Neighborhood organizations and school boundaries might also be considered. It is important to focus on compactness rather than on linear areas. Further, why aren't counties considered communities of interest? All the voters of many counties choose the same commissioners who make all of the decisions about what goes on in the county. Consider the problem of Linn County, with only one large city, Albany, where most citizens do shopping, use the courthouse, fairgrounds, etc. However, Albany is in a different legislative district than the rest of the county. Why do the people of Sile and Lebanon supposedly have more in common with the people in Malala than the people in closer Albany? The results lead to less correct political representation. And another, I live in Northwest Portland, Multnomah County, and chair legislative districts and a congressional district with Washington County. But our interests are much more aligned with other Portland areas, including the other side of the Willamette River, which is part of the district line. Much of our district is much more rural than we are. Another, across the state, there are 17 community college areas, 7 university areas, hospital districts, and community consortiums for federally funded community action programs. Where do they fit in? The Willamette River in Eugene is both a barrier and one that really changes attitudes. The rural areas of Bonita, Cottage Grove, and Junction City all are connected to the larger Eugene districts because of population, but they lose identity. And after I had written a testimony, I received some other ones that I want to call to your attention. This one is from Clackamas County. The concern in our area is that when redistricting last occurred, we were put together with Hood River. And now our representative, this is from the Clackamas Court about Welch's. And we were put together with Hood River. And now our representative and senator are both from Hood River. The Welches does not even have the same interests as the Hood River area. Unfortunately, this occurs due to population and area constrictions when forming the districts. I know this occurs in many areas of the state, but it does create a challenge, and we know that it gives you a challenge to doing districts, but bear in mind that places like Welches do not share interests with Hood River. From Curry County, the person who wrote this was saying currently Curry County's House of Representative district is part of the one that goes all the way up to Roseburg. Thus, the district is approximately evenly split between the parties. It would be possible to gerrymander conservative Curry County in with other rural areas of southern and eastern Oregon to just one or two districts, thereby increasing the number of liberal representatives coming from Oregon. What he's pointing out is that right now there is competitiveness in the district they're in. Some changes of lines could change that competitiveness. This is a sampling of the various versions of community interests you will see and be hearing about in the next few months. Trying to balance all of the criteria important to redistricting is a serious challenge. The League will be encouraging our members to attend your hearings to help citizens understand the process and to assist you as we can. Thank you for this opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Kathy. Francisco, why don't you go ahead?
Yes. Buenos dias. Good morning. Chair Bonamici, Co-Chair Garrett, and Lindsay. For the record, my name is Francisco Lopez, and I'm the Executive Director of CAUSA Oregon. CAUSA is the largest Latina and Latino civil rights organization in the Pacific Northwest. We were co-founded 15 years ago by PECUN, Oregon's Farm Workers Union, and we work in the areas of voter registration, education, and mobilization, as well as leadership development and advocacy and public policies that have an impact on our Latino community in the areas of immigration reform, housing, education, health, jobs, and the economy. CAUSA has offices in Portland, Salem, Eugene, and Bend. As many of you already know, the 2010 census data came out yesterday or the day before, and Oregon's Latino population now represents almost 12% of the population of our great state. In the year 2000, we represented 8% of the population in our state. We grew 63.5% in the last 10 years. In fact, Latinos accounted for 43% of the total state population growth between 2000 and 2010. Here in Marion County, home of the Oregon State Capitol, the Latino population is almost 25% of the total population. I would like to respectfully submit to you the following recommendations in order to make the redistricting process fair for our diverse state. Given the growth of Latino voters across the state, when the legislature does its road tour of redistricting hearings, there should be targeted outreach for Latino participation at all the hearings. It is legal to draw majority-minority or minority opportunity districts, and this should be done, as you can see, as the current legislation doesn't reflect the diversity in our state now. Redistricting is about representation, not just elections. It is therefore important to not dilute clusters of Latinos. While they might not be large enough to elect a Latino, they deserve representation that will otherwise be unattainable in the area if the area is split between two or three districts. Non-citizens also get political representation since they are persons under the Constitution. Redistricting is based on that premise, that there should be equal representation for equal number of people, including citizens, non-citizens, and young people alike. Even if the people under 18 are non-citizens and cannot vote. Since everyone who lives in a district is affected by governmental decisions, they all deserve representation. considering the importance of redistricting, it is important for the Latino community, the Latino population, to be involved in the process, especially given the rise of Latino population in our state. We intend to ensure that the new districts are not designed to benefit one party or another, but rather to provide Latinos their fair opportunity to elect candidates of their choice without considering what the partisan outcomes might be. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Co-chair, Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gracias por estar aquí esta mañana.
Gracias, Representative Lindsay.
I have Spanish blood. I've got some Latino blood, speak Spanish. Would you consider me part of your community?
You are part of my community, the community of Oregon. You all have Latino blood, and I don't, that's important, and definitely you are part.
Okay, and then the second question I have is, how do you define Latino community? We got El Salvador, El Salvadoreños, Peruanos, Argentines. All sorts, Central America. How do you define Latino?
Well, Latino is either the roots are from Latin America, or they were came from Latin America, or their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents were from Latin America. Like when we talk about Irish American, you know, there is some ancestor that came from Ireland. Polish American, the same, or Italian Americans. I think the same with Latin Americans, even though that among Latin Americans we have, in my case, I'm a Salvadoran American. We have Mexican Americans, Argentinian Americans, but yes, it is either the roots were in their country of origin, their ancestors, or they came directly from that any Latin American country.
Just a follow-up. And then how would you define Latin America then? I guess the point I'm trying to get here is we have to figure out, we have broad discretion on what a community of interest is, and we have Latinos, we have Latin America. That's a big swath.
Yeah, it's from all the way from Mexico, Central and South America, mm-hmm. and the Caribbean.
So your definition of Latino American would be from Mexico to...
Either they were born there or their ancestors were born there. And that's basically what the census data was talking about when they were defining the Hispanic population of Latinos. So remind that the concept of Hispanic was done during the 80s. President Reagan, and back then they decided to use the term Hispanic. But most of us in the Latino community consider ourselves Latino because not everybody has Spanish blood or European blood. Mm. And we have indigenous communities. You know, we have a large indigenous community here in Oregon from Oaxaca, Mexico, from, you know, Southern Mexico, so that's another group, very important group. And I would like, Nat, that you mentioned that that's another group, and we have a lot of people that are indigenous communities in Latin America. They should be involved in this representation because part of the labor force in our state.
Okay. Just one last question. So you'd agree that we have one big umbrella, Latino, and then under that we have separate community of interest, El Salvadoreños,
of course, yes.
Mm-hmm. Depending on each district.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Co-chair. Chair Bonamici. Sorry.
Thank you, Co-chair Garrett. Thank you for your testimony. Just a brief comment first and then a question. Mr. Lopez, you talked about reaching out to the community. We will probably within the next day or two have on the Oregon State Legislature redistricting webpage the schedule of our road trips. And so we are, not just for CAUSA, but for all the interested organizations, that's going to be available. And we will be really hoping that the organizations can help do the outreach to your communities. And then my question is a follow-up to Representative Co-Chair Lindsay's question, and you were talking about the definitions, and I wonder if they differ from the definitions that the U.S. Census Department used, because the data that we use is from the U.S. Census, and they have very specific definitions.
You know, actually, you know, one great thing that the census did, and we work very close with it, they expanded the definition a little bit more, because they found that many of us, you know, we rather prefer, you know, we use the term Latino, Latina, but they kind of expanded the definition a little bit more. So that was one of the great things that happened in this census, that we actively participated. But I think that's a little bit expanded now. And, you know, we are working in the confines of the census. You know, census still use Hispanic, but when they threw the forms at the community, they even used the word Latino when they were doing the outreach.
Thank you.
Yeah, and just want to respond to your comment. Definitely our organization is very interested in the outreach, and we will help the committee in any way, shape, or form to reach into all Latinas, Latinos in our state to make sure that they are involved in this process. You know, it was amazing to see recently the voter turnout at the last elections among Latinos and the midterm elections. We were surprised to see that in midterms we never expect good big participation, but almost 55% of Latinos voted in the midterm elections, higher than any before, and in 2008 where 75% of Latinos voted in the general elections in 2008. So we are very excited about the possibilities and opportunities now. So I thank the committee for listening to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Our next pair will be Janice Thompson and Reverend Santos Lyons, please. Either one of you can proceed.
thank you. Janice Thompson with Common Cause, Oregon. The first page of the testimony, which I will kind of email because it just kind of outlines the topics, but then tried to also introduce some graphics. So the second page, you know, just kind of tried to present a graphic. Obviously, you know, the real world drawing wouldn't be done with, you know, a straight edge like this. But just trying to illustrate the whole notion of minority vote strength not being diluted. And then if you flip to the third page, one illustration of how not to do that is to ensure that the group with the blue M, are in one district. To visualize a minority opportunity district, imagine that, you know, say two or three of those blue M's were replaced with what should be yellow O's. My printer was starting to fade out there. But that helps you see what a minority opportunity district would be, which the dynamics in the state could well be that is something to strive for. So obviously, redistricting plays out in terms of elections, but it's also really important to recognize redistricting influences representation. And so the next kind of slide tries to illustrate a small community district that should be retained within one district just to facilitate representation. In this slide, you know, kind of a small area is split between three different areas. And it's not that it's in the next one, then those four are, you know, lumped into one district. And this is not an opportunity where there may be an this may not be a situation where there's an opportunity for a candidate perhaps to be successful from that particular community of interest. But it's more than just about, you know, candidate viability in elections. Is also important in terms of representation. And I think, as you've heard with other earlier comments, you know, the small from the legal folks, a small community of interest doesn't need to just be a racial or ethnic group. One example that might, like I thought about just the other day because it was snowing, and this might play out more in a city redistricting area, is, a small area like that could be a hilly area where the people might kind of, bond over the fact that they need different snow removal services than some areas. In terms of representation, the other factor to keep in mind is that everyone counts. The U.S. Census does count everybody as required by law, and everyone is to be provided representation, which is why everyone counts in redistricting, including those who aren't eligible to vote. And there is actually a Ninth Circuit Court decision that confirms that all people count in redistricting as well, that governs us here in Oregon. So again, it's kind of about elections, but it's about representation as well. The next slide kind of goes through a number of the topics to consider, most of which you kind of have heard, so I won't necessarily repeat all the various angles there. The next to the last slide, a couple of key points. As you also have heard, county and city boundaries are obviously important criteria, but they may not always work, especially in urban and suburban boundaries. Schools, school districts could be a factor. One other thought is to consider using urban growth boundaries, which would also have the added advantage of creating districts that would be less likely to have population changes because they're urban growth boundaries. And then finally, a suggestion to address what's popularly called prison gerrymandering. This I think I first testified on this back in either 2007 or 2008. That was a bill on the House side. Right now, there's the bill is 720, and what it does is count Department of Correction inmates for the purpose of redistricting by their last pre-incarceration address. And so this addresses what's sometimes called prison based gerrymandering by adjusting what the Census Bureau does, which is count incarcerated people as residents of a prison rather than their community of interest. And from a community of interest perspective, that for prisoners seems to be much more accurately their home before they were incarcerated. It's important to note that this issue plays out in terms of drawing legislative district lines, but also at the local level. For example, unless the city of Pendleton makes some adjustments in their city council districts this time around, they may well have a city council ward that is 28% prisoners. So it's important to think about this not just in terms of state lines, but allowing this option for local governments as well.
Thanks, Janice.
Okay. Hi, good morning, everyone. Chair, members of the committee, my name is the Reverend Joseph Santos Lyons, and I'm with the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, is a 501c3 nonprofit. We work on public policy and do civic engagement work. We're nonpartisan. Involvement in the redistricting process has been a relatively recent endeavor for the Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders here in Oregon. Participation has increased significantly here and across the country after the 1990 census, as there has been continued growth in our communities. Historically, areas with significant Asian or Pacific Islander populations have been split into different districts, which has reduced the voting power and representation of our community. These splits have negative impacts on our economic opportunity and our civic engagement. For example, the riots in Los Angeles after the Rodney King trial took a heavy toll on Koreatown, and when residents appealed to the local officials during the recovery efforts, city and state officials passed the buck, claiming that the area was a part of another district. And in fact, Koreatown was split into 4 different city districts and 5 different state districts. In Oregon, Asian and Pacific Islanders alone or in combination number around 150,000, or 4% of the population. I myself am the descendant of a Chinese father and a Czech mother. We are the second fastest growing community here in Oregon. We reside primarily in Washington, Multnomah counties, but we're also heavily geographically dispersed in the region. While we have a community that's growing in visibility and our civic participation, including voting, we are presently not large enough in size to constitute a majority-minority district. We do have a growing number of small and medium communities that share cultural interests, social, and civic life. Our communities in Beaverton, Alloa, and Tigard in Washington County, East Portland in Multnomah County, and Happy Valley in Clackamas County are areas where we have seen real growth, real investment in small businesses, schools, and neighborhood life. A couple of examples are we're seeing an increase in Pacific Islanders in Marion and Jackson counties, as well as in eastern Oregon cities such as La Grande. And in the Multnomah County area, we're seeing refugees from Burma and Bhutan settling, who have actually made up the largest number of refugees coming to Oregon over the past several years. Asians and Pacific Americans increasingly identify and integrate into multiracial neighborhoods. In the Portland Tri-County area, Marion County, and Lane County, Asian Americans and Pacific Islander communities, organizations, churches, and businesses have established formal ties with other minority communities, leading to a higher level of cohesion, sense of community, shared interests, needs, and leadership. Finally, I urge you to consider race in an appropriate way in Oregon's redistricting, given the deep disparity of political representation amongst communities of color and minority communities. There is a compelling interest to create minority opportunity districts. Race has always been a factor in redistricting, and the law permits that the process be race conscious. I encourage you to give race proper consideration to help ensure that Oregon's plans maintain or improve minority opportunity and do not dilute our voting strength. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you both. The questions for either of our panel?
Let
me start with Representative Holby.
Thank you. This question is for Janice. You mentioned the incarcerated population. And I've had some questions about that that I've been trying to sort through a little bit. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on, you know, how the prison population is counted in the census and then how that impacts any particular district in its representation of population versus a district that doesn't have that population.
Co-chairs, Representative Holby, the census counts prisoners where they are incarcerated. And so the fundamental solution to this is to ask the census, and there is work underway with the census, to, for the next time around, to seek out their last known, you know, pre-incarceration address. So that's where the fundamental problem is. But given that the census operates in this way, it does create these situations that have, you know, kind of resulted in people kind of using this phrase, prison-based gerrymandering. To use, back to the Pendleton example, if you had a, if this council district, you know, does indeed include 28% prisoners, that would mean that every three residents who live next to that prison will be given as much influence over city policy decisions as every group of four residents in the other wards. So it creates disparities, and that's where the gerrymandering factor comes in. Like I say, I think in Oregon, that's an element. I think the other element just is also just a community of interest issue with and thinking about it from a representation issue, it's just not quite clear that, representation of the interests of those prisoners is best carried out, or would be, let me put it this way, would be better carried out by the folks who represent the areas where they were from as opposed to where they're incarcerated, where they're really not considered, you know, part of the community.
All right. So we have Chair Bonamici, Co-Chair Lindsay, and then Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Representative Holvey asked my question.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so I've been trying to figure out this as well, and the prison population issue. And a couple questions for you are, one, how do we determine where they originate from? First of all, I think some criminals that are incarcerated might be transient in the first place. That's the first thing. And then second, some have different sentence times as well. That's another issue. Maybe you can comment on that. And then in some states, I know they farm out their incarceration. I think even Hawaii sends their inmates to another state. Could you just comment on what the solutions are to this proposal on those questions, maybe?
I'll definitely try. But Representative Lindsay, I missed a word. Could you rephrase the second question you had?
So the second one was some inmates are going to be there for life.
Oh, life. Okay.
And some are going to be there for 2 years, assuming.
Okay. I just.
How do you parse that up?
Right. Actually, this is mapped out in Senate Bill 720, and the Department of Corrections here actually keeps better records in Oregon than a lot of other states. So actually, it's not, it's less of a problem here. But the last known address is the residential address where the inmate was, resided before incarceration. There is a provision if an inmate either has an unknown address or is not a resident of this state, there's a provision that is actually already done for, in terms of redistricting for Oregon residents who reside overseas, to just remove them from the overall population count. So that's how you would deal with...
I'm sorry, could you restate that last part? You said Oregonians living overseas would
right.
be removed from the overall population?
Yeah, because they don't... So in terms of coming up with the numbers, they are... This is my understanding. Is it... There's an adjustment so that they're factored in. I can explain this. They're factored into the statewide population because they're considered an Oregonian.
And when you're saying they, you're saying the inmates, or are you talking overseas?
Overseas.
Okay.
But the option is to not factor them in to the design of any particular district because they don't reside in any particular district. So that approach could also be taken for those inmates who either are also from another state, like you mentioned, or their pre-incarceration address is unknown.
Okay.
I can get you more information on this.
That'd be helpful. And actually, that leads to a follow-up question, and that is, how do the Oregonians that are overseas, are they based on the origination as well for census county?
Yeah, so the total count for the population of Portland or the state includes them, and they're definitely represented, in the context of statewide races and things like that, and federal statewide contests. But there can be adjustments made since they don't reside in one of your districts,
So let me just clarify. I'm in House District 30.
Mm-hmm.
The military personnel that originate from House District 30 are, when the census is done, are they counted in House District 30?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Okay.
So in that case, it's their home address in Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to confuse that.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. I want to follow up with what Co-Chair Lindsay was on, because both the people that are incarcerated as well as those overseas, is there a different standard on the overseas if they're either military versus people who are U.S. citizens who last lived in Oregon who now live in let's say, a European country or some other country and doing something that's non-military work.
Chair, co-chair, Senator Prezanski, I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't know the answer off the top of my head. But I'm pretty sure I know where to get it.
I understand the populations we're talking about is probably small in number. And I think the last part of this is the part about those who are incarcerated, because I was going to also ask about those based on sentence. Because to me, if you have someone that is serving a death sentence,
mm-hmm.
or if they're on life without possibility of parole, it seems like their time is going to be where they're at, as compared to if they're, which is going to be the vast majority of our inmates returning back to their community. Is that something that the Senate Bill 720 distinguishes between them? Or are we just saying because they came from a particular county, even though they may never return to that county, they should still be considered part of that county?
Senator Prezanski, I'm going to have to double check. I think that this is addressed in Senate Bill 720.
You can get back to it, Senator.
But I'll get back to you on that.
Can I just make a comment, Mr. Co-Chair? When Professor Levitt gave us an initial presentation, we had a discussion about this, and I believe he made a comment about those who are serving a life sentence and said that because the number is so small, it's a statistically insignificant number. So I don't know how it's considered in the several other states that have already passed legislation dealing with those who are incarcerated. So it might be helpful also to have maybe our committee staff look at, compare the, if we're going to consider this issue, to look at the other states that have passed legislation and how they deal with that issue.
Madam Chair, if I can follow up, I think the importance to this is that we need to know what our framework is going to be in our guidelines, because we're setting the record. We want to make certain, I agree, and that's why distinguish that we're talking about a very small population, but I think it's going to be important for our setting the record if and when someone challenges. Everyone knows what we relied on, so it's clear and the courts can rule on it without wondering what we might have meant.
Thank you.
Are there further questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, just one comment. You mentioned that necessarily a prison population would not be a community of interest. I would just wonder, an area like right here in Marion County, where there's probably four or five facilities, including county facilities, would not the neighbors and the people around there that are being represented consider that a big part of their community, and the resources that go into that and the security and all those things, community of interest?
Co-chairs and Representative Cameron, that's why you're going to have hearings. I mean, that's, you know, I think folks will tell you that. So I'm sure there's some that think that and some that don't.
Okay, and just one other point I'd probably like to just put on the record. It's not a question, but just in this particular community of interest where there are facilities, the population, even though a lot of those people are coming out, that population does not go down. In 10 years, it's actually increased, so there's more people there that have to be taken care of within the community of interest.
All right, thank you both. Our next panel is Katie Fast and Midge Purcell, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Garrett, Lindsay, and Juan Amici, and members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. And thank you for the opportunity to give testimony on communities of common interest. I think Farm Bureau feels like our ability to come here and give our perspective shows that you're considering rural areas and the agricultural community as you start drafting the redistricting plan. And we feel that communities of common interest are one of the most important pieces of the requirements that you're looking at. That, along with requirements that prevent the favoritism of one party. So those two items are, feel like,
tell our members, feel like those are the two most important items as you start putting a plan together. These factors, as you look at them, they give legislators like yourselves an ability to represent their communities, and I think in a better light, as you have communities that have common interests and common factors, it allows for a concise representation here at the legislature. Communities of common interest we see are ones that have common economic basis. As Oregon's largest or second largest industry, agriculture is an important driver in many communities throughout Oregon, and that economic impact goes beyond the farm. It goes to the suppliers in the community, the markets that we are participating in, be it farmers markets, food processors, or distributors, also professional services that we utilize, like accountants and attorneys and bankers. And many times these business activities happen within a region. One rural community might not have all the suppliers and the interests that one farmer needs, so he is traveling within his region and to communities of common interest to get that work and business activity done. 1 in 12 jobs in Oregon is related directly to agriculture. When these families' livelihoods are supported by a common economic factor, they will have commonality values that they carry over into their communities. As well, communities with their foundations based in natural resources have more in similarity to other communities based in other economic industries. So as an example, a timber and a ranching communities will have more in common than a timber and a high-tech community would have in common. For rural residents, there's a strong social and cultural tie between communities also. Residents travel between small communities to access medical care, attend school events, socialize, and worship. These communities also share common news sources, papers, radio, and television. They have school rivalries, share community events and festivals. And they also share regional descriptive terms to describe the area in which they live. And I'd like to use a few examples to better explain where we think the current plan works well and where we feel it is underrepresenting rural interests. And I'd like to use Central Oregon as the example. And I'd first like to say we do not believe that the representatives in Central Oregon are doing a poor job representing their community. But we feel like the current plan creates challenges in representing those communities. The first would be House Districts 53 and 54. And from our perspective, the donut hole around Bend provides a division where you have commonality in the city of Bend in terms of that community that is very different than that outlying rural area. And so from our perspective, there's probably more communities of common interest surrounding Bend that are kept whole under common representation. And then subsequently, the city of Bend, it has a community feel that is different than those surrounding cities. However, when you look at House Districts 55 and 59, we believe that there are important communities of common interest that have been divided under the current plan. One example would be Prineville and Madras. For our members, those are communities are tied very tightly together. While they are in different counties, there is quite a bit of economic activity in terms of natural resource-based communities that goes on between those two. And the challenges that you give to legislators that represent those communities is in House District 55, the people of Prineville then are combined with Jackson County and Klamath County, which have very different community values than those in Central Oregon. Subsequently, when you look at House District 59, that goes all the way over to Grant County and kind of a loop and brings in Wasco. And in 59, not only are you trying to combine some very diverse communities there, but the city of John Day is split at the only stoplight in the county, which we don't believe is an appropriate boundary to be using. When you take that house district and you combine it with 60, from an agricultural base, you are putting that Senate district in a way that it's representing Madras, Wasco County, Grant County, Harney County, and Ontario that have very different rural values and agricultural bases. In central Oregon, you're going to have specialty seed crops that are grown. In the Wasco County, it's a very heavily wheat, cherries that have very different issues in terms of the agricultural productions. And then you move into ranching communities in other areas in Ontario that they're dealing with potatoes, sugar beets, and other crops. And so they have very different interests. There are other examples like that throughout the state. One area also I'd like to touch on is the coastal communities and some of those districts that then stretch into and over the coastal range into inland farmland that has very diverse interests and values in those communities, along with challenges in the growth of Washington County, where you have very different economic bases in those counties. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead with Midge, and then we'll take questions at the end.
Thank you. Good morning. Yes. Representative Garrett and members of the House Senate Redistricting Committee. My name is Mitch Purcell, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Public Policy for the Urban League of Portland. Our organization's mission is to help empower African Americans and others to achieve equality in education, employment, economic security, health, and quality of life through both direct services and advocacy and civic engagement, and we've been doing so for the last 65 years. I'm here today to share some of our thoughts for your consideration as you deliberate the process of redrawing the state district's lines, especially in regards to defining communities of interest. We are having this discussion as the state and country digest the publication of the 2010 U.S. Census. In Oregon, as in the nation, the census confirms that we are a state that is growing in diversity, with Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, and African Americans becoming an increasing share of the electorate. The African American community, the community that my organization represents, is larger but more dispersed. When the last census was done, 65% of African Americans in the state lived in Portland, mainly in four census tracts in Northeast Portland. Now, as a result of what many believe to be misguided urban renewal processes, which accelerated gentrification, African Americans remain the majority in only one census tract. Many have moved to surrounding suburbs in search of more affordable housing, and they usually have fewer services, less social and community cohesion, and diminished opportunity for representation that reflect their legislative concerns. So as you consider redrawing district lines, I would urge you to consider the composition of the state legislature. We didn't need the census data to tell us that the current makeup of the legislature does not adequately reflect the racial diversity in the state. And we hope that this redistricting exercise proactively addresses that underrepresentation. We're fortunate in Oregon. In other states, advocates have to rely on the protection offered under the Voter Rights Act to ensure that minority vote is not diluted by redistricting. This is not an issue in our state. However, there are opportunities for the legislature to take voluntary measures to preserve and enhance voting strength of smaller minority populations and increase the chance of minority representation, even when populations are smaller than the majority.
I believe we have the option of establishing minority opportunity districts in areas where populations in minority communities continue to grow. One of the ways is by broadly defining communities of interest. It can be a neighborhood or community that would benefit from being maintained in a single district because of shared interests, views, or characteristics. Communities of common interest can be multiracial communities that include Latino, Asian, Native American, African American populations, where our communities singly may not have large enough populations to constitute a majority minority district. We urge you to consider redistricting plans that acknowledge our strength as combined communities. We advocate for districts that promote voting strength and increase the opportunity to elect candidates of our choice that are responsive to our joint interests. Oregon's communities of color are way ahead of many other states in the relationships that have been forged between our communities. There are strong alliances amongst African American, Latino, Asian, and Native American communities based on shared inequities and huge disparities in poverty rates, education, housing, health outcomes, and employment. As our communities grow, redistricting that enhances the capabilities of our communities to have greater representation and participation in the democratic process would benefit the entire state. I believe that Oregon already has in statute as criteria of redistricting that communities of interest be taken into account. We suggest that the inclusion of our joint communities under this definition would lead to greater voter empowerment and a redistricting plan that is fair and equitable. In my written testimony, I also addressed the issue of where prisoners are counted and the impact they have on redistricting. I think Janice dealt with that quite some detail. But I would reiterate that because Latinos and African Americans are incarcerated at 3 to 7 times the rate of the white population, where incarcerated people are counted has a tremendous implication for how African American and Latino populations are reflected in the census and consequently how these communities are impacted through redistricting. I believe that there are several state legislatures, including New York's, that are now considering proposals to correct the misuse of prison populations in state redistricting plans. And Maryland, I believe in 2010, became the first state to adopt a bill to count incarcerated persons at their home for redistricting purposes. There's also an issue of undercounting. During the last census, the undercounting of African American males between the ages of 30 and 49 was 8.2%, and the overall undercounting of African American males was 4.19%. I end with those points to reinforce the fact that there is inequity inherent in the system of representation for African Americans and other communities of color. I urge you to proactively address and redress these issues in your approach to redistricting. A more representative electoral process is good for our state and good for democracy. Thank you for hearing my remarks.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions for either of our panelists? Thank you both. We have, I think, 5 more on our list, and we have about 25 minutes left, so we may need to be a little more concise in our comments. So I'm going to start with Craig Honeyman and Michael Mason, please.
Well, I'll be glad to jump in, Co-Chair Garrett, Chair Bonamici, Co-Chair Lindsay, and members of the Legislative Redistricting Committees. My name is Michael Mason. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. to discuss this idea of community of interest. And this is a little like deja vu because I testified 10 years ago on similar similar issues when redistricting was being considered then. You know, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs is made up mostly of the Wasco tribe, I should say, from the Columbia River. The Warm Springs tribe, which is several bands, the Thai Valley, the John Day bands, and bands from other tributaries of the Columbia and Central Oregon, and exiles from the Great Basin, a number of Paiute members who used to live on the large reservation, Malheur Reservation, north of Burns, but due to the Bannock War, were banished from their lands and have ended up having a community on the south end of the Warm Springs Reservation. Of course, as you may recall, the Warm Springs Reservation created by the 1855 treaty. So it's a reservation community that existed before statehood, and I think goes without saying that the reservation as such is a community of interest, of a community of common interest. But it's also a unique political entity. First Oregonians, of course, surviving and now surrounded by waves of immigration. And the languages still survive, though sadly Kikch, the language of the Columbia River, is only spoken by a handful of Wasco people anymore. And I think the devotion to this community is demonstrated by people sticking, even with 60% unemployment and a severe housing shortage. Now, the community, though, is not bounded by the reservation borders. I think it's the main point that the people at Warm Springs would like you to hear. Certainly, partly because of the housing and job shortage, the economic crisis in Warm Springs, there were many people who live in Madras. For many reasons, it wouldn't make sense to separate Madras, for example, from the reservation. I think we also take Ms. Fast's point that Prineville is really part of this community also. But in a larger sense, the community of interest that the Warm Springs people see is bounded by not the reservation and immediately adjoining towns, but the treaty ceded area boundaries, which basically go from Bonneville Dam upstream, a little ways upstream of the John Day River mouth, encompassing most of the John Day drainage up into Grant County, then south and west along a line south of Bend, south of Deschutes County actually, and then back north along the crest of the Cascades. And I say this because the Warm Springs people are still exercising their treaty fishing, hunting, gathering, and grazing rights throughout most of that area. They have lands throughout most of that area, except in Deschutes County. So they would, let me just say that they consider the current districts an improvement over the last century when the districts were drawn at the north end of the reservation, and thus the Lower Deschutes was not included in the district. That is very important to them. It's their central fishing river. They own a lot of property along the Deschutes. Shearers Falls, that Shearers Bridge area, is a large area for them, very important area for them for fishing. If you've been along there, you would see that. And likewise, I think leaving Celilo and Celilo Village out of their districts would not make sense to them. So this connection to the Columbia is very important, and it's a reason that you see tribal leaders here testifying on bills to reduce toxins going into the rivers, going into the fish, and working on fish health issues. So their ideal district, based on their community of common interest, would follow the treaty ceded area lines. And as I was saying, there's a big improvement now over what it was. They are very pleased that the District 59 does include, all of Wasco County. Ideally, it would include you know, could include Hood River County as well. But I understand that there are some difficulties in drawing these, but I hope that the committee will consider that this is, you know, it's like the way I was raised, that my clan motto is "No Oubli," do not forget. The Indians have not forgotten where they came from. They're still going back to the river to fish. This whole area is very close to their hearts, and to the extent that you can keep it within, you know, one or two districts. Right now, it's scattered across, you know, four house districts. But to the extent that you can keep it contiguous, they would very much appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity, and apologies that Louis Pitt could not be here today to speak more eloquently to their connection to the land.
Thanks very much.
I'm happy to answer your question.
And Craig, and we have your written testimony. We're starting a little short on time, so if you would mind just kind of summarizing rather than reading what's already in the record.
Absolutely, I will be happy to paraphrase. Co-Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Craig Honeyman. I'm here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. We represent all 242 cities in the state. We're happy to be here to help you try to understand and deal with the issue of communities of common interest. My comments, both the verbal and those that you have in front of you, are from 25,000 feet. It's not my intent to, and you're not there yet, get into discussions of how specific districts ought to be drawn. Yours is not an easy job, but let me pledge going forward that the League would be happy to help out in any way we can. As is always the case with large questions that cover the entire state or multiple jurisdictions, one of my messages this morning is one size does not fit all. There are multiple definitions or descriptions of communities of interest within the context of redistricting, and you've heard about many of them today. And one definition doesn't apply because from one community to another, one region of the state to another, different priorities in terms of community of interest necessarily apply. If there's one message I could leave with you today, it's that hopefully you'll understand that even throughout the state, within legislative districts, even to a certain extent within congressional districts, there are certain characteristics which tie or bind certain communities and groups of communities together. And you've heard the recitation of what they might be: urban, rural, culture, ethnicity, economic base, occupations, etc. We would hope that you endeavor to understand those strengths, those ties, and do nothing or as much as possible, not dilute those strengths. If possible, in other words, keep communities whole, not necessarily cities, but keep communities whole. In 2001, it's my understanding that there were certain non-statutory policies that were adopted during that exercise. One stated that possible cities should not be split between districts. Another way of saying that was there was an objective that stipulated that cities smaller than 58,000, which I believe was going to be the size of a legislative district at that time, should also not be split up. While we don't necessarily disagree with that proposition, we're not sure that it necessarily should trump other community of interest criteria, as others have talked about today. For your information, I have attached a list to my testimony, a list of cities in Oregon that are currently represented in the legislature by two or more House and or Senate districts. This is offered just for your information, without comment or without judgment. There are other considerations you may want to consider: community dependency, oftentimes economic dependency that cross municipal incorporation lines. In larger urban areas, you may want to consider avoidance of a kaleidoscope of districts to include not only legislative districts, but water districts, school districts, etc., which may add to the cost of elections, for one thing, voter confusion, even voter dissatisfaction with the governmental process. There are other practical considerations, such as space between populated areas, availability of transportation linkages, travel times, etc. In conclusion, let me just say that The league is happy to be here today. Community input, as you've heard before, is going to be critical to this process. We applaud you for going out on the road for, I understand, 12 field hearings over the course of the next couple of months, and I pledge to you that the League of Oregon Cities will do everything we can to promote attendance and participation at those field hearings by people with interest in Oregon cities. So thank you very much for your attention. Appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you both. Do we have questions for other panelists? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, our final group is James Morales, Jerry Bohart, and Mike Hoagland. And I would ask each of you, if you're submitting written testimony, to try and paraphrase it for us rather than just reading it. That way we'll get through each of you and have time for questions. Thanks. Any order you like.
Okay. Chair Bonamici, co-chairs Garrett and Lindsay, James Morales, Benton County Clerk, also representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I have provided to you some talking points as well as an example map. So I figured maybe some visual zoom in of Northeast Benton County might help to highlight some of the challenges that Oregon election officials have to deal with in dealing with legislative districts and congressional districts that don't seem to follow the same philosophies. And in doing so, you know, I want to thank you for the opportunity for being here, to be here and discuss this with you, as well as just to let you know that the Clerks Association appreciates the testimony from the Oregon League of Oregon Cities in that we feel that keeping our counties, our political subdivisions, as much as is possible in the same legislative districts is going to be an important part to allowing us to put the rubber to the road when it comes to implementing the elections, putting the ballots together, and keeping our voters informed through the voters' pamphlets and the common materials and issues that they'll be dealing with in electing their representatives and dealing with the measures that affect them and are of common interest to them. So I didn't plan to read from this talking points that I have before you, so I'm not going to do that. But I'm hoping that they will highlight for you to review as you go through some of the areas that we commonly deal with when we're putting together the ballots, and that would be, of course, cities, the ward, and some counties actually have county commission districts. We have fire districts that we must account for when we're putting together. So the multitude of boards that have elected officials, as well as the taxing districts that put forth measures to the voters. So when you're going through, I know you've got the challenge of the congressional district might not offer as much flexibility in the amount of variation that you're going to be allowed. But to consider those congressional districts when you're drawing the legislative districts, I think would be helpful. As you can see in the example I provided, it appears that the legislative districts, if you'll note that the green line is the Senate district, the blue line is the congressional district, and the red dashed line is the state house districts, that they did appear to take into consideration the city of Corvallis and like the city of Philomath and North Albany. But when the congressional lines were drawn, we had Corvallis, a piece of Philomath, as well as North Albany were all split in congressional districts. So by asking that when you get the congressional districts, and we are going to be cheering you guys on, because the more time that the county clerks have to implement the districts that you have, the better the opportunity that we'll be able to put that in together accurately the first time around without having to scramble to make corrections at the last minute. So we appreciate, and we're cheering you guys on. We're hoping you get it done, and it doesn't go to the Secretary of State, because that, of course, shrinks our window to implement. So thank you very much for the opportunity, and good luck.
Thank you. Mr. Hogan?
Thank you, Chair Garrett, co-chairs, and members of the committee. It's good for Metro to be here. I'm the research director at Metro in Portland, Oregon, and I'll skip all of the details about who we are and what we do. I was asked to come down as a technician, essentially, and relay a little bit about how we're thinking about this issue. We have 6 elected nonpartisan council districts for the Metro Council, and so we're going through this same process right now for redistricting, and so we've given it a little bit of thought, and we also did this the last time 10 years ago.
Before you go on, I think you did not identify yourself.
Oh, Mike Hoagland, research director at Metro in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you.
We did look at this 10 years ago, but as you're aware, obviously, the census comes out every 10 years, and you tend to reinvent the wheel. So we're looking at it again. I want to talk a little bit about what we've done and what we think about communities of interest. The last time we did it, we had a number of considerations that we wanted to for our redistricting, and we had a population target of no greater variation than 5%. We looked at some other things like trying to avoid fingers and peninsulas that reach out and try to grab one part of the community or another. But and on the communities of interest piece, we kept it really simple. We thought about a number of the things that you've heard today from the testimony, but really our 3 categories were cities under 15,000, what we call centers in our regional growth plan. They were developed in the 1990s with a lot of community outreach and support, and they were identified as areas that have a lot of community interaction. They are areas that encompass a lot of places that people go to, libraries, plazas, shopping areas, businesses, certainly downtowns and main streets and those sort of places. So we tried to draw our districts and include those things in total. And then we also tried to keep watershed boundaries, neighborhoods, and community planning organizations whole in our work. So that was really what we did, and I think you've heard that from others. This time through, though, just as to restart the process, we're thinking about a number of other aspects of our communities of interest, and certainly geographic features are important, major rivers or streams, hills, park features such as Forest Park is a divider in our area between certainly districts, we think. But again, it's probably more of a guideline. It's a bit of an art rather than a science. So to the degree that you can use any of these factors as a guideline or a consideration may be more appropriate than trying to set it in stone. Certainly you want to develop certainty, but it seems to me and seems to us that you need to have a little bit of variation and have some common sense in your final delineation. Diversity is an area. It kind of depends on whether or not you're trying to recognize a diverse community or enhance an opportunity to have a diverse electorate. So we haven't really figured that one out yet, and I think that we're going to be thinking more about that. Jerry is going to talk a little bit about transportation routes, but just remember that they can both be a divider, a good divider for a community. Think of TV Highway in Washington County. It's a good divider between the north part of Washington County and that southern part. But as it moves into Beaverton, it actually becomes the main street, and it's actually a central part artery of that community. So we drew our boundaries a little different when TV Highway got into Beaverton. So think about that. Another factor that we've used is what we call a perimeter to area ratio, and the state, we use the same GIS, Geographic Information Systems, computer mapping. It's a thing that will allow you to look at whether or not there are any odd-shaped districts, any fingers or peninsulas that I've mentioned. So you can take a shape file and look at the perimeter distance over the total area of that shape file and kind of start to look at those ratios. That's one of the things that we've done. And then finally, we've done some work looking at what makes a community. We've developed an activity spectrum, and it starts to categorize an inventory. And we've been able to do this because we're a single metropolitan area. It may be harder to get the data from the state, but I think that most people know their communities, where we've looked at what's the whole community? Where do you have a plaza, a library, a school, a church, other things that people go to and need? You know, in our area, we even broke it down into where's a brew pub and coffee shops and all those sort of places that people like to go to. And the more of those you have, the higher score you get. And so if you're looking at comparing, well, where do we draw a line? Well, where do you have the community that maybe has the higher activity spectrum, which then would lead to probably more mingling of people, conversation, the sort of thing you like to get with public discourse. So that's something that we can work with your state staff with if you're interested in something along those lines, and we'd offer up our services. So with that, I'll be quiet and we can move on. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, question.
Just thank you for your testimony. It's really good, especially the brew pubs. That's interesting. The diversity reference. When you say diversity in here, what are you referring to?
Representative Cameron, members of the committee, the way we think about diversity is from an equity, social equity standpoint, and as the Metro Council or our partners in the region make decisions, we're looking at, well, number one, are distinct communities benefited or burdened from those decisions? And then we're just in a process now of trying to delineate what those communities are. There's elderly, there's racial, there's ethnicity, there's income levels. There are actual sort of some of the other factors that you've heard from other presenters create that diversity. But we're primarily talking about the diversity that you might be most aware of, the type of stuff that came out in the census yesterday or
Thank
the day
you.
Before.
All right. Jerry, bring us home.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Garrett and committee members. For the record, I'm Jerry Bohard. I'm the Interim Deputy Director of Operations for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I'm actually here to, I think, just talk about a couple of words, and that is be connected by the transportation links that's in the ORS. And I know that you've actually been spending time this morning talking about some of the barriers, but what does it mean to be connected by the transportation system? And so I actually think that some of the documents that I gave you probably speak better than any words. You have 11 by 17 that really illustrates all of our transportation facilities, whether it's roadways, airports, marine ports, railroads. So you get a good sense of the interconnectedness of our transportation system. The other thing that I provided is we do this on a biennial basis, and it's the official state map. And it really just shows the roadway system, kind of the areas where a lot of public lands, such as our forest lands and so on. It also shows, I think, some of the key communities, whether you're talking about Portland or Cave Falls or so on. So you can see the connectedness to the communities via the transportation system. And there's a lot of numbers in my testimony that I don't think I need to get into with regards to the amount of mileage that we have for each of those. The other question I think that was asked as we were talking to committee administrator was around our GIS capabilities and the tools that we have. And as Mike mentioned, all of this was done on GIS. And this was the first time that the state map was done on GIS. So really all of this information that you see on the state map are what we call layers that we can grab and do different things with. And as a state, we have a great data sharing agreement with DAS's geospatial office. So actually all of this data is really available kind of on a statewide level. So our roadways at the city and the county and the state level, a lot of boundaries, whether you're talking about our area commissions on transportation, I heard someone mention our metropolitan planning organizations, obviously a variety of political boundaries, whether we're talking about cities or counties, legislative districts, all of that has been digitized as well as a lot of environmental information, whether we're talking about rivers or all of the things that could be a barrier to the communities. I think Mike mentioned a little bit about land use. That's more difficult at the state level, but we do have the city and county boundaries, I think, that start to get you to some of that information. So that really, I think you can see that our transportation system really does connect most of our communities, and I think there was also concern, are there ever any times where there our communities are isolated? So we do look at some of our roadways do get closed for weather conditions, and those are actually identified on trip track. But for the most part, I think you can see that our system can connect pretty much all of our communities as you go through your work. So I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Do we have questions for any of the three? Thanks for sticking around through to the end. We appreciate your testimony. Everyone else, this was some really high-quality testimony we got today. Thank you. I had my weekend reading. So with that, we will close the informational meeting for the House Committee on Redistricting.
And adjourn the informational meeting for the Senate Committee on Redistricting.
Further business, we are adjourned.